Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be here. So this is going to be a bit of a strange talk because on the one hand, I would like to give an overview of this topic that by now has become quite large, of this correspondence between four-dimensional n equal to 2 superconformal field theories and vertex operator algebras, which in physics parlance are usually called chiral algebra. Those are the purely holomorphic sector of a two-dimensional conformal field theory. But also I'd like to tell you about some recent progress. And so I have a sprawling set of projects with different combinations of many collaborators. And we've been extremely slow in putting this work out. And so this is an opportunity to tell you a little bit what we have been up to. And we'll see how it goes. So this morning I had many more slides than I could present. So this morning I decided to cut the number of slides and put some of them in the backup slides. So I'll start a little slow. It's going to be somewhat of an abstract talk. There will be not a single picture, unfortunately. I didn't know what kind of figures I could put other than cartoons that it's not my style. And please interrupt me because otherwise it's going to be a talk for an audience of one. And that should be avoided. Okay, so let's get started. So we're interested in n equal to 2 four-dimensional superconformal field theories. And apology if you don't know what these words mean. Unfortunately, you're not going to really learn it here. Superconformal means it's both conformal and supersymmetric, and it's two supercharges. And we're interested in them from really two viewpoints. I'll start with the algebraic one, and soon after we'll see the geometric one. So I take it for granted that you know that these theories can be characterized abstractly in terms of the algebra of local operators that obey this OP. Schematically, here you have local operators inserted at point x and y in four dimensions. And there's a complicated OP with complicated structure constants and generally non-integer dimensions. And you can reconstruct the whole theory by inserting the OP in arbitrary correlation function. That is familiar. And what I'm also going to take a little bit for granted is that you know that this theory has a superalgebra. Will be a bit schematic, but the important pieces of a superalgebra are going to be really the bosonic subalgebras and the supercharged bosonic subalgebra. I don't know if this pointer is very visible. Maybe I can. Do you have a stick?
Yeah.
Wonderful. So there is the bosonic subalgebra, which is a product of the standard conformal group. This is Poincaré and conformal and relation generators, and then I color coded the art symmetry part of the algebra. Green will be the SU2 non-abelian piece, and red will be the abelian piece. So I think I've been consistent in my slides, and it will be important because these two gadgets have very different character, as it turns out. And so we can then label local operators by their quantum numbers under the five Cartan generators. E is the conformal dimension. Bigar is the Cartan generator of SU2, which is green. Little r is the U1R charge. And then there are the Lorentz quantum numbers, G1 and G2. OK, so in general, for arbitrary choices of the quantum numbers, this is immensely complicated. Of course, some progress can be made using numerical bootstrap methods and whatnot. But the theme of this talk will be that if we specialize these quantum numbers to special values, then this becomes a lot more tractable. And in fact, this whole four-dimensional OP structure collapses to something which is much more analytically tractable, which is a two-dimensional chiral algebra. OK, so that's very schematic for the algebra structure. Now I will switch to the geometric structure we'll be interested in. And here you see where the color code is important. These theories have a moduli space of supersymmetric vacua, zero energy. So if and only if the energy is zero, you have supersymmetry. And in general, these supersymmetric vacua are complicated, but I'm going to focus on two canonical branches. One is the Coulomb branch, MC, which I will define by the branch where the U1R symmetry is spontaneously broken, where SU2R is preserved, and the Higgs branch is the converse. So the U1R is preserved and the SU2R is broken. So those of you who are familiar with n equal to 2 supersymmetry, we recognize the Coulomb branch in Lagrangian examples will be the case where I give a VEV to the complex scalars of the vector multiplets while not touching the hypermultiplets, and here I do the opposite. This is the case where I give a VEV to the hypermultiplets, but the Coulomb, the vector multiplets are untouched. And both are extremely interesting. Coulomb branch is the realm of Cyber-Witten geometry, which is extremely beautiful and rich. But today we will really focus on the second branch, which is the Higgs geometry. And one of the enduring mystery of the subject is that you can actually reconstruct pretty much, I think it's a plausible conjecture, that either branch suffices to give you full information about the four-dimensional theory. And so this is something that perhaps I'll come back to at the end. This poses a really great conceptual question, which is, given that the data on each separate branch is sufficient to reconstruct the theory, there has to be some very non-trivial map between the two, and that is, there are many hints that such a map exists, but understanding it fully is one of the main challenges. But for the most part, today we will focus on the Higgs geometry. Okay, so now let me tell you a little bit more about the geometry of the Higgs branch. And I'm trying to appeal to your previous knowledge. So in examples where you have a Lagrangian, the geometry of the Higgs branch is given by the hyperkähler quotient. So you have a bunch of hypermultiplets whose complex scalar I'm indicating here by Q and Q tilde. Those are in the UV. And then you have to quotient by the relations that come from the superpotential and form gauge invariant operators. So this is hopefully this notation is clear enough. It's the standard way in which you start from a Lagrangian, which has a bunch of hypermultiples which are charged under various gauge groups. You construct the standard type of gauge invariance and mod out by superpotential relations, and that defines the Higgs branch of vacuum. So that's something you can do whenever you have an explicit Lagrangian realization. But it's unsatisfactory because a lot of the theories that we want to study do not have such an explicit Lagrangian realization. So there is actually an equivalent but more intrinsic characterization of the Higgs branch in terms of giving VEVs to gauge invariant chiral operators that obey certain shortening conditions. And the shortening condition, which is relevant here, is where the conformal dimension is twice the R. Big R. Remember, the big R is the SU2R symmetry, the one that is spontaneously broken on the Higgs branch. And so there are 1/2 BPS operators, which are scalar operators that obey these shortening conditions, and their vacuum expectation values tell you where you are on the Higgs branch. So by the usual kind of arguments, given that these operators are BPS, the OP is non-singular. And so I can literally put them one on top of each other, and this defines a commutative product. So that's what we call the Higgs branch chiral ring, R sub H. And it's generally believed, and that the standard rules of algebraic geometry apply. Everything you want to know about the geometry of the Higgs branch is encoded in the algebra of the chiral ring. Okay, this is unproven because I don't want to bore you with one of my pet complaints, but we know essentially nothing about how, given the data of a conformal field theory at the origin of the moduli space, what that tells us about when we move on the moduli space. This is the notorious question of spontaneous conformal symmetry breaking. Very little is known about that. So here I'm assuming something which is really part of the general lore, that we can characterize the moduli space of Vakia in terms of the chiral ring, which is computed purely in terms of the conformal data at the origin of the moduli space. This is part of the lore, but well, we'll have to assume it. Okay, so a few things that I want to plant in your head. So there's a little bit of math jargon, but okay, commutative is clear. C algebra just means that the identity is there, and so there's the complex numbers are part of the algebra. And then a word that is perhaps a little less familiar, which will play a role in the rest of the talk, is reduced. Reduced means that if I take an element of the ring and I take an arbitrary product, I never get zero. So if that were the case, it would be that the element is nilpotent. And experimentally, it turns out, you can compute these chiral rings in a variety of superconformal field theories, and you never get nilpotents. This is not so innocent as it sounds, because you can easily find counterexample the moment you relax the conformality condition. So n equal to 2 theories which are not conformal typically do have nilpotent elements. And so this actually is something that I've challenged mathematicians to prove in Lagrangian cases. This becomes a theorem in the context of writing down a quiver and proving that it's true whenever the beta function at each node is zero. It should be elementary, but somehow it's not. And anyway, this is believed to be true. It's experimentally true in all cases, even in the non-Lagrangian ones. And then if that's the case, we can make this, again, standard identification. We're going to identify C of MH is the ring of holomorphic functions on the branch. It's a little bit of, again, math terminology. We're going to identify the Higgs branch chiral ring with the coordinate ring on the branch. Okay, so it looks like they're almost the same thing, but please appreciate the leap that I'm making here between the geometry of the moduli space, which is something that is defined when I spontaneously break conformal invariants, so that's the right-hand side, whereas the left-hand side is a purely algebraic thing that I can compute at the origin of the moduli space in terms of the standard data of the conformal field theory. Okay, so a little bit of math terminology. So, of course, it's MH is holomorphic, but it is a little bit more. And the reason is that the Higgs branch also has a hyperkähler metric. And we will not really make use of the hyperkähler structure very much, except for the fact that if we think of it as a complex manifold, it induces a symplectic form omega, which means there's a notion of a Poisson bracket defined on the branch. Okay, and finally, the fact that each operator has a well-defined conformal dimension, which is equal to twice the Hart symmetry, means that this manifold is really a cone, right? So you can rescale each element of the ring by a complex number, which is non-zero complex number, and under that rescaling, you really have a cone. That's a reflection of the fact that we're looking at the conformal field theory. If the theory were non-conformal, it would not necessarily be a cone. Okay, so, and in our normalizations, generators that have r equal to 1 are special because they correspond to global symmetry. So from the point of view of the representation theory of the algebra, if you have an operator which has r equal to 1, remember that means it has conformal dimension 2, I can add with 2 supercharges and find a vector of dimension 3, which is a conserved current. And so global symmetry, which is related to conserved currents, are associated with generator which has r equal to 1, not normally denoted by Lyapunov map. So this is all standard material, but if I'm going too fast, stop me. It's established in some dictionary. Unfortunately, there's a little bit of terminology. Okay, so let's look at some example to get some intuition. The simplest example is just C2. That's the smallest dimension which you can have an hyperkähler manifold. And here, then it means that I have 2 complex coordinates that I'm calling Q and Q tilde. Those would be in the physics context, those would be the complex scalar, the 2 complex scalar in a hypermultiplet. So polynomials in Q and Q tilde correspond to the ring holomorphic function on C2. And the bracket is the obvious one. These are like position and momentum in quantum mechanics. And here, notice that the assignments of little r is 1/2, because E is 2r, so these are the standard free fields, free scalars in four dimensions. Now, OK, that was easy. Let's look at the next example. The next example is a famous one. So we take a quotient of C2 mod Z2, and you can give a description of it in terms of three operators, three variables, which are J1, J2, J3, which are subject to the relation that J1 squared plus J2 squared plus J3 squared is equal to 0. And the bracket is the standard one that you guess by noticing that there is a natural SL2 symmetry that rotates them. So this is an example where we see, for the first time, the emergence of a symmetry. So the assignment of R here is 1. And indeed, there is an SL2 symmetry that acts on this space. And then I'm going to stop to yet another elementary example, where now we have C2 mod Z3. C2 mod Z3 does not have a full non-abelian SL2 symmetry. It only has a U1 symmetry. And then correspondingly, we find there's a generator of dimension 1, of R equal to 1. And the other two have assignments R equal 3/2. And again, this is a quotient that can be described by this simple XY equal J cube kind of relation. OK, so I hope this notation is clear. This means the space of polynomials in three variables subject to the relation that X times Y equal J cube. And of course, this generalizes to the whole class of C2 divided by any ADE group, and you get more complicated relations. It's a sort of a famous story, and these are the sort of simple examples of non-compact hyperkähler manifolds. So they're basically although we have extremely complicated examples, and the whole talk will be illustrated with these baby examples, and the same example will come over and over and over again. Till you will really be bored with them. But please keep in mind that we also have more interesting examples. Questions?
What are the actions of the Z2 and Z3 here?
Say it again?
What are the actions of the Z2 and Z3 groups?
OK, so well, it's a standard one. So you have AB go to minus A minus B, that would be my Z2 action. And then I can form invariant objects, which are AB, A squared, and B squared. And then in some notations, these would be, I'll call this J3, I'll call this J plus, I'll call this J minus. And then J plus J minus is equal to J3 squared. Okay, so is that clear? Okay, so great. Okay, so finally I can present. So actually, I lied. There's one picture. It's this one. So this is. Again, I will omit all the details, but you have taken my word. There is a map that will decay by chi, that given a generic four-dimensional equal to superconformed field theory associates to it a VOA, which is, again, just a chiral algebra, the left-moving part of a 2D CFT. And the map arises by passing to the cohomology of a certain nilpotent supercharge, which schematically is Poincaré plus conformal, but the details will not be important. And it turns out that in order to be in cohomology, the operator will have to lie on a certain fixed plane that depends on the specific quantum numbers you have chosen here, but up to conjugacy, any plane would do. And it turns out that the dependence on Z bar is exact. So by this usual kind of cohomological argument, you find that the resulting correlation function only depends on the coordinates in a meromorphic way. Okay, so this is precisely the kind of structure you expect for a chiral algebra. And then the four-dimensional OPE that was complicated collapses to the standard kind of meromorphic OPE. That's the idea. I will not give you the detailed construction. But I have to spend a little bit of time, and unfortunately, I mean, I'm sorry, this is probably the, there's a bit, again, a bit of terminology and a bit of color coding of these various quantum numbers that I have to go through, unfortunately. So we have the state operator map in conformal field theory. So I can think of operators or equivalently think in terms of states. And the states that survive in this chiral algebra to cohomological reduction are states or equivalent to operators, which are called Schur operators, which are specialization. So I start with five Cartans, and I'm going to impose a shortening condition, essentially, that comes from the fact that this will be annihilated by some supercharges, that says that E is equal to 2R plus L. Well, L is essentially the spin. So I chose a plane, and so rotations in the plane have associated a certain angular momentum, and L is that angular momentum. So already at this level, you can see that this looks like Higgsy, right? It's Higgsish. Because if I were to set the angular momentum to zero, I recover the shortening condition I had earlier, that E is equal to 2R. So this means that the operators that survive here are the Higgs kind of ring operators, plus a lot of other stuff that has angular momentum on the plane. In particular, holomorphic derivative on the plane would add, each holomorphic derivative would add a unit of angular momentum, and so derivative, holomorphic derivatives survive in the game. It turns out that although I only impose this relation, there's another one that comes for free from four-dimensional unitarity that would set little r equal to the difference of the spins. But today, I will mostly focus on theories where little r is identically zero for simplicity. You can find theories where all the Schur operators have this trivial quantum number. So we start from five Cartan, the Schur relations reduce them to three. And so it turns out then that this map would map a four-dimensional operator with these three quantum numbers to a two-dimensional chiral operator where the holomorphic dimension is the sum of big R plus L. And we focus for simplicity on operator have little r to zero. So there are only really two quantum numbers to keep track of, which is the holomorphic dimension H, which is r plus L, and r itself. I could choose that combination. Now, unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know, it's just a fact of life, that whereas the holomorphic conformal dimension behaves in the obvious way under operator product expansion, you count the number of z's and you have an equation that sets the left-hand side equal to the right-hand side in the standard way, the green R is not conserved in DOP. However, can at most decrease, and so there is a natural filtration. It's not an actual grading, but it's some sort of filtration. Things can be smaller or equal than something. And so this is an important fact that I'm now going to bracket, and I will come back to at the very end, that one special feature of VOAs that come from for this are not completely generic. They have this hidden additional R filtration. Now, if I know exactly my four-dimensional theory, I can follow through the map, I can assign the R filtration. But if you come around and tell me, OK, here is a VOA. Somebody gave it to me from four dimensions, and you just give it to me in the standard presentation where you just have a bunch of operators with their OPs, the R filtration may be a little bit hidden. You have to work to recover it. OK, so that was, unfortunately, a lot of notation. But if there are questions.
And this is true for Lagrangian and non-Lagrangian.
This is completely structural. OK, so I'm going to go very fast. Again, I will not justify any of this. I'm going to enumerate a bunch of structural properties. Some of them are obvious. Some of them are not obvious. One thing that is obvious is that both Boson and Fermi statistics are allowed. Of course, you can have fermions, so that's okay. No big deal. This is the second property requires a bit of explanation, but it's also very obvious. What is the simple question? A simple question from a math perspective is a VOA or a chiral algebra where null states have been set to zero. And this is for us is automatic. If you have a null state in four dimension, that becomes a null state in two dimension. And null states are not really something, sure, you can think about them if you want, but they're really not there. You're always quotienting out by them. So if you want to think in terms of null states, feel free, but remember that you have to quotient by them. You always have the quotient of the VOA by the null states. Another question? Yes.
So if you start from the Lagrangian theory, so there's a BRST description.
Yeah.
Are the null states automatically gone?
So the null states in that description sometimes are Q exact.
But in Q cohomology?
In Q cohomology, they're just not there. Some null states are trivial in the sense that just come from the fact that when you have a composite and you rewrite in terms of the elementary variables, you have relations. So those relations, you could think of them as null relations. And some are a little bit less obvious because they're only zero in cohomology. Now, a structural property which is deep is that although this construction of putting operators on the plane only guarantees that I have conformal, the only conformal generators that I'm guaranteed to have are the ones that leave the plane invariant, it turns out that there's an infinite dimension enhancement. And all these VOAs, in fact, have a stress tensor, which morally descends from the 4D stress tensor. And the central charge of the 2D theory is minus 12, the C vial anomaly of the 4D theory. Remember, there's these two vial anomalies, C and A. A is the one that is monotonic around energy flow, and this is the other one. So in particular, this means that all of our VOAs are necessarily non-unitary. If they come from a healthy, unitary 4D theory where C4D is positive, C2D will be negative. OK, so some trivialities. There's no space statistics. And then an important object, which is sort of obvious for what I told you so far, the vacuum character of the VOA by construction coincides with the index that counts the Schur operators of the four-dimensional theory. OK, so then V is always believed to be finitely strongly generated. OK, so that requires a little bit of explanation. How do we normally present chiral algebras? For example, the Virasoro algebra, the single generator T. You give in the OP with T with itself, and you're done. You have a W algebra, you have two generators, one of dimension 2 and another dimension 3. You give me the OPs of this generator with themselves, the singular terms of OPs, and you're done. Those are the strong generators. A finite set of generators and if you give me their singular OPs, they completely characterize the algebra. And in our case, we only find a finite number of them. And then another important relation is that all the generators of the Higgs branch chiral ring become generators of V. But in general, there's many more. Now, I'm going to skip on this, although I have some extra slides if in the extremely unlikely case that we have time at the end. You can establish a sort of a more sophisticated dictionary. And one nice dictionary you can establish is the following. You start from a four-dimensional theory, which is a certain associated VOA by the Matt Kai. And then you can play games on it. And one game that you can play is a move on the Higgs branch. You move on the Higgs branch, flow to the infrared, and what kind of four-dimensional theory will find there will correspond to some other VOA. And rather nicely, this operation, which has a 4D interpretation of an RG flow on the Higgs branch, has a beautiful two-dimensional counterpart in terms of a certain cohomological reduction on a Zwicky-Zhukov reduction of the VOAV. And as Kevin was just mentioning, another bit of this dictionary corresponds to the fact that you can start with a four-dimensional theory that has a certain global symmetry. The simplest case, you have a bunch of free hypermultiplets that have a certain global symmetry. And you want to gauge a subgroup of this global symmetry in such a way that the beta function is zero, so that you get a conformal field theory. If I know the vertex operator algebra that corresponds to the theory before gauging, I can canonically consult the vertex operator algebra that corresponds to the theory after gauging by another kind of BRST procedure. I already mentioned the Sidenhall filtration, and then a very important property that I'm leaving for the very end is the fact that although the two-dimensional theory is non-unitary, the four-dimensional theory is unitary. So four-dimensional unitarity must imply something about the 2D theory. OK, so that's my lightning summary of this long story. And I'm sorry if it's a bit vague and conceptual. questions before I go ahead, because from now on it will be a little bit wishy-washy and speculative. Okay, so we have this map, and one very striking feature of the map is that it given two different four-dimensional superconformal theory, they have different chiral algebras. So the sort of slick way of saying is that the chiral algebra appears to be a perfect invariant of the 4D theory. If you know the chiral algebra, presumably there's a unique theory that has that chiral algebra. However, the chiral algebra, so that's progress, because chiral algebra are a much simpler object than four-dimensional n equal to two theories, but still they're pretty complicated objects. So the question I'd like to ask, sorry, before I get there, so clearly the map, so that means that the map is injective. However, it's definitely not subjective in the sense that there is a ton of VOAs that we know and love that definitely do not come from four-dimensional theories. For example, any unitary 2D chiral algebra certainly cannot come from a healthy four-dimensional theory. But we'll see, and it will be the main thing of the rest of the talk, that the VOAs that come from 4D are extremely special. And so the outstanding problem in this business is try to precisely characterize what makes them special. And if you could do that, then you could perhaps axiomatize, you could add some axioms to the standard axioms of a vertex operator algebra that encode the fact that they come from four dimensions, and perhaps that will lead to a much simpler classification problem than for all of general VOAs. Classifying general VOAs is essentially hopeless, they're too complicated, but perhaps this narrower problem has hope. Sorry, there was a question.
Yeah, I have a really annoying question. So suppose you take n equals 4 for SUN or PSUN. Do you want the same?
Oh, yeah, sorry. I should have qualified. I'm identifying four-dimensional theories. I'm completely neglecting information about the extended operator. So I only care about the local operator structure of the 4D theory. Sorry, yes. And then, and that's where I'm going to head in the next few slides, although this chiral algebra is a simpler gadget, can we find something even simpler? Is there an even simpler algebraic invariant that characterizes the theory? Okay, so finally I'm going to tell you something new. Okay, so this is something that, again, I hope we will not. So this is the slide where we risk reducing the audience to an audience of two, actually. I misspoke. But so let's go slow. So there is a natural commutative algebra which is associated with the vertex operator algebra, which is called RV. It's a finite dimensional algebra. And okay, so the symbols might be I will have to use the blackboard here, but let's at least read the slide first. So this is some stupid notation that simply means we are quotienting out by all the operator that contains at least one holomorphic derivative. In words, it's simpler. So let's do an example. Let's do a couple of examples, actually. Let's start with the Virasoro algebra, right? The Virasoro algebra means that we have T of Z, T of W, which obey the standard OP, which I'm not going to write down. I assume you know the OP of two stress tensors. So what are, in terms of states, well, the states are T, del squared T, etc., as well as all of their composites. T to the K, del T to the K1, DL1, T to the K2, etc. Any kind of normal order product of this kind, which has a bunch of T's and a bunch of holomorphic derivatives, is a state of the algebra. And what this quotient means, we're removing all states that contain holomorphic derivative and just be left with products of T with itself. So if you have several generators, say we're in the situation we have a Kac-Moody algebra, again, the general state would be arbitrary normal order product of arbitrary number of holomorphic derivatives acting on J, and we are just left with the JAs and their products. But of course, we should not forget that the original theory generically had null relations. For example, I don't know, in the Ising model, well, let's do another example. Let's do in the 2.5 minimal model, there's a relation that says that t squared is equal with some coefficient to the second holomorphic derivative of t. So when I pass to this quotient, that means that in the quotient, t squared will be set to 0. So hopefully this explains this relation here. What is this space here is simply all the polynomials in the original generators of the algebra quotienting out by the null relation that you have in the original algebra once you forget the derivatives. And it turns out that this is not only a commutative algebra, but it also actually has a bracket, which is induced by the single order poles of the four-dimensional OPE structure. Okay, so I'm now going to define, I'm going to use the standard relation between algebra and geometry. If I have this kind of commutative ring, I can interpret it as the ring of functions on a variety, and there's a one-to-one map. So I can go between the ring and the variety in a one-to-one way using algebraic geometry 101. And so there are two natural spaces which are associated with this gadget here. One, which has the tilde, which is the space as formally associated to the ring. And another one is the one that is associated to the same ring, but where I have bodied out by nilpotent elements. Okay, in general, this space has nilpotent elements. And if I mod out by it, I get RV reduced, and that defines a space XV, which is called the associative variety. Whereas this gadget here, in general, has nilpotents, and so it's what mathematicians would call a scheme. Okay, so the guy with the tilde is a scheme, and the guy without the tilde is a standard variety. So to give, we will do example in a minute. But this is perhaps not so well known in physics. It's a simple construction. To every chiral algebra, you can naturally associate a space. In fact, you can say two spaces. One, which is an ordinary kind of space. It's an ordinary kind of geometric structure, which is the associative variety. And one, which is a little bit more refined, because it has this additional notion about nilpotent elements, and it's a scheme. And so the idea then is, can we, in some way, distill all the information we have about the 4D theory in these simple geometric invariants? Okay. So to recap, I start from a four-dimensional n equal to 2 theory. I construct the view A by my map chi, and to it, I can associate this gadget with the tilde, which is a little bit more refined than the gadget without the tilde. Once, if I have the gadget with the tilde, I can always find the one without by removing nilpotent elements, but clearly the one with tilde has a little bit more information. And I would say the central conjecture in this whole business, still unproven, but it really appears to be true, is that the Higgs branch is nothing but the associative variety. It's just XV. Okay, so that's a remarkable fact, if I may say so. So we have this complicated geometric object, which contains a lot more stuff, apart from the Higgs branch. But there's a canonical way to just distill the Higgs branch, which is to compute the associative variety. The associative variety of the VOA is the Higgs branch. That is the central conjecture. Well, but the gadget with nilpotents is a little bit more powerful because it has a little bit more information. And so it's natural to call it in the physics context the Higgs scheme. This is not something physicists could have come up without this whole construction. But this is a refinement of the Higgs branch by a little bit of extra information. And so the experimental fact, again, from now on, it will be a lot of experimental facts for which we like proof. But the experimental fact is that I told you that no two different superconformative theory have the same VOA, but there are a ton of examples of different superconformative theory have the same Higgs branch. In fact, most trivially, there's a ton of four-dimensional superconformative theory who have no Higgs branch. So clearly, the Higgs branch alone is not going to be enough to characterize the theory. But remarkably, if I add this little bit of extra information contained in Hilpotent, then we have no counterexample of two different four-dimensional superconformative field theory where the Higgs scheme is the same. So that leads us to conjecture that the Higgs scheme would actually be a perfect invariant of the 4D theory. And this is a vastly simpler object than anything you can think of, in particular, a vast simple object of the chiral algebra. No, it's finite dimensional object. This is a finite dimensional algebra. We'll see example in the last slides. Okay, sorry if it's a bit abstract. Yes?
Is there a simple physical understanding of these nilpotent generators in terms of Higgs branch?
There is no simple physics understanding in terms of Higgs branch because this goes a little bit beyond.
Yes.
But for example, one, as will become apparent in a minute, one of these nilpotent elements corresponds to the 4D stress tensor. So these are additional stuff that you're keeping track of, including the 4D stress tensor, which is always nilpotent, experimentally always nilpotent. Okay, so here I have to introduce a little bit of math terminology, but it's simple. If the associative variety is trivial, then V is called Lis. And this is, although it's not unproven, it's believed to be a necessary condition for the VOA to be rational. Some of you may be familiar with rational conformal field theory. The VOAs that you see there, I don't know, Virasoro minimal models or affine Kasmudi algebra, integer level, etc. One reason why the associative variety is not a popular concept, perhaps, not as popular as it should be, is that it's absolutely trivial in all of those cases. The associative variety is just zero. It's a point. It doesn't exist. However, if the associative variety is symplectic, or as a mathematician would say, is a finite number of symplectic leaves in the Poisson structure, then that's a generalization. It's called quasi-Lis. And don't be afraid of this finite number of symplectic leaves. It simply means, I told you there's a Poisson bracket. And intuitively, you can think of it as a Poisson bracket as being non-degenerate. So this is the intuitive notion of having a symplectic structure. You have a Poisson bracket, and it's non-degenerate. If it were degenerate, it means I can find a direction that basically commutes with everything else. And that means that if I specify a value for it, and I do an orbit under the Poisson bracket, I find a leaf for one value, leaf for another value, so I have an infinite number of leaves. So saying they have a finite number of leaves is simply a statement that the symplectic bracket is the Poisson bracket is non-degenerate. But of course, that's exactly what we have in four-dimensional Higgs branches. The Higgs branch has a symplectic structure. That means that the Poisson bracket is non-degenerate. And so although, in general, our VOAs are not Lis, they're always quasi-Lis, if you believe our central conjecture. So assuming this correspondence with the Higgs branch associative variety, all our VOAs are quasi-Lis. And in particular, there's a very special subset of them, which are the ones which have no Higgs branch, and those would be the ones which are called Lis. And it turns out, this is very recent, I think, if I may say so, partly inspired by our works, mathematicians Arakawa and Kawasetsu noticed that although these are extremely poorly studied in mathematics because they go well beyond the case of rational VOAs, it's a very interesting generalization that preserves a lot of the good properties of rational VOAs. And in particular, you'll be familiar with the fact that in rational conformal field theory, you have your action of the SL2Z, you have characters, they form nice representation of the modular group. Something very similar is at work in the case of quasi-Lis VOAs. And so for our purposes, one of the striking conclusions of this is that the Schur index, which is the vacuum character of the day, must satisfy a certain modular differential equation. That is a very striking fact, because from a four-dimensional viewpoint, you never suspect that the character, this particular character would be modular. And that's where it comes from. And then, as a side remark, we proved recently in a little note with Brandon Rahon that this is just a math fact. Any quasi-least UA must have rational central charge. And so that gives you a way to prove that the C anomaly of a 4D n equal to 2 superconformality theory is actually rational, which is a nice little structural fact. And with a little bit more work, you can also argue that A is rational. So the general conjecture is that n equal to 2 implies rationality. N equal to 1 would imply that the A and C central charge would be algebraic numbers. And n equal to 0, anything goes. OK, so let's do some examples. And again, here we will see the example I had at the beginning of simple Higgs branches. We'll come back now here. The simplest example is a class of,
I imagine thinking of some of these conformal field theories that depend on some number of colors, analytically continuing the number of colors to some funny value, then they would not be rational.
Yes, but I don't know. But Okay, so everything is contingent upon this Higgs branch conjecture, that the associated variety is the Higgs branch. We don't have a proof, but it's, I would say, 100% certain that whoever proves it will have to use, for example, the fact that the 4D theory is unitary. I mean, it will have to hinge on some hard fact about four-dimensional physics, such as unitarity or, I don't know, analyticity. I mean, so,
okay.
Yes, I'm sure you can cook up counterexamples, but in those counterexamples, presumably, the basic Higgs branch conjecture will so sorry about the terminology here. So there are certain sequence of four-dimensional theories which don't have an explicit Lagrangian description. The labeling is a bit unfortunate, but it doesn't matter what it is. They're known as Algiers Douglas theory. Forget about the name, it's just some theories. You can think of them as black boxes. But one of their claims to fame, so these are labeled by A1, A even. One of their claims to fame is that they have trivial Higgs branch. And we can actually compute, in this case, the chiral algebra. It corresponds to the Virasoro algebra. At the value of the central charge, it corresponds to the sequence of 2,2n plus 1 minimal models. So 2,5, 2,7, 2,9. So I gave you the example of 2,5 a few minutes ago there. So this is an infinite sequence of minimal models, which are very much not the unitary one. The unitary sequence would be n, n plus 1. So this is some other infinite sequence. And it's the one that, for some reason, arises in physics, in this particular physics. And we will see a lot more of them in a minute. So as I was saying here, there's a single generator, which translates to a single generator of this algebra after I take this quotient by derivatives. And because I have an R relation of this kind, that means that T to the little n is equal to 0. So this is the simplest sense of a scheme. You have a single generator such that T to some power is 0. T squared is 0, the simplest case, the cube is 0, etc. This is sometimes called a fat point. It's a point, but there's a little bit of structure because it's not quite a point. It's like 2 points or 3 points, whatever, or collapsing at 0. But then it's clear what we have to do. Clearly, the only generator I have is nilpotent. So if I mod out by it, I'm left with nothing. And that confirms the fact that the Higgs branch is trivial. But notice that, well, if I keep this little bit of information, then I'm actually able to distinguish which particular of this infinite sequence of theories I'm talking about. And so in this case, we confirm the fact that knowing the Higgs scheme distinguishes four-dimensional theories. And there are no other examples known to humans where the VOA is just the Virasoro algebra. The only case where the VA is just a dilatoral algebra is this particular sequence. And in this particular sequence, this additional bit of information, which is the n, which is encodes the index of the potency of t, is sufficient to distinguish the four-dimensional theories. Okay. So the next example, not surprisingly, will be, the next example is a little bit more elaborate. And this is in some work in progress. You can look at, just to impress upon you the fact that this is not totally trivial in some example. There's also a little bit more elaborate example you can do. There's some other stupid class of Argyris Douglas theory that correspond to some W minimal models. But the W minimal models are very special. They have very special values of the labels. And again, in all these cases, the Higgs branch is trivial. And you can go through the same exercise. You can carefully compute this RV. Now, there are two variables, one that descends from T, and the other that descends on the operator of dimension 3 in this case. And you compute their relations, and you convince yourself that by the time you reduce nilpotent, you just get a point. But again, the information contained in these algebraic relations, which you see, they're sadly different, right? You know, you might have these two. You really have to carefully look at the slide to see that they're different. But the relations are different, so they distinguish these two models. OK, and this comment is for the experts, but maybe we'll come to it later. OK, so. And finally, an example with Higgs branch. In fact, an infinite class of examples, which again, some stupid other stupid class of theories, which is A1, comma, D odd. These are some Argyris Douglas theories that all have the same Higgs branch. So there's another case where just the Higgs branch wouldn't be sufficient to distinguish them. But now, this theory corresponds actually to SL2 at some funny fractional level. And if you go ahead and compute this space, it's three variables that correspond to the tree generator of SL2, subject to a relation of this kind. So this is the Casimir to the power n times the generator. So you see the relation is different. And so if I mod out by nilpotence, in all of these cases, I will find that the Casimir is set to 0. So geometrically, I just recover C2 mod Z2. But the scheme structure distinguishes between the theories. OK, so these are simple examples, but they're meant to impress you with the fact that the scheme structure distinguishes theory, where the Higgs branch doesn't. OK, so that leads me to the next natural question, which is, can we actually reconstruct the VOA from this Higgs scheme? Given that the Higgs scheme appears to be a perfect invariant of the 4D theory, perhaps it's also sufficient to reconstruct the VOA from it. And and here is something, again, experimentally very funny, and I think probably deep, but who knows? In general, no. In general, in the general world of VOAs, if I go from V to RV, there are many Vs that have the same RV. And here is a simple example. I take the 2.7 model and the 3.4 model. The 3.4 is the standardizing model. They both have an null of this kind, t cubed plus derivative is equal to 0, which means that their RV space is, again, a single t subject to the relation t cubed equal to 0. So the two models have the same RV. But it turns out, rather remarkably, that in some cases, RV is actually sufficient to reconstruct not quite the VOA, but a certain commutative limit of the VOA, known as a vertex Poisson algebra. And those cases are precisely the one that we experimentally find in physics. That's a remarkable fact. So let me guide you through the story quickly. So you don't have to know the details here, but you just have to remember the fact that there's a natural way to organize the space of states by counting the number of holomorphic derivatives. So if I define Fn as a state of space at least n holomorphic derivatives, well, that clearly contains the space that have at least n plus 1 derivatives. And now if I take this quotient, So I take states that have n little morphic derivatives, but at least n, but not n plus 1. That is a way to reorganize the vector space that, in particular, gives me a commutative algebra. Okay, so there's a certain way, given a non-commutative algebra, if you have a filtration, you can naturally take a commutative limit using that filtration. And so I will get an infinite dimensional commutative algebra, which in fact will inherit a certain generalization of the Poisson structure, but let's forget about that. And then the question is, can I reconstruct the commutative limit from the Higgs scheme? And one natural thought is, okay, well, I start from a finite dimensional algebra of this kind. I have only t. How do I add derivative backs? Well, simply formally construct the ring that contains t, its derivative is double derivative, blah, 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 subject to what? To the Eurlesianian relation that said t to the n equal to 0, to the derivative of the relation, blah, 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 blah. Okay? So that clearly is an operation that, given a finite dimensional algebra, reconstructs for me an infinite dimensional algebra with derivatives. And the question is, does this agree with the original commutative algebra which has been written? In general, the answer is no. So in general, the best you can say is that this gadget here is bigger than this. And in the cases where they precisely agree, the VOA is very special. This is recent work by these mathematicians, and it's called classically free. I'm not really sure why it's called classically free, but that's the name that they chose. Okay, so to recap, I realize the story is a bit involved and conceptual. I start from the theory, I descend to the VOA. From the VOA, I mod out by derivative, and I get a finite dimensional gadget that also has nilpotents. And the question is, can I revert this error? One natural way to revert the error is to start from the finite dimensional object and take all of its generators and augment them by the derivative of all of them. That's the way to revert the error. But in general, these two operations don't commute. And they commute only in very special cases, which, for mysterious reasons, are precisely the one that we encounter in physics. And so, for example, it has been proven by the mathematician that the only minimal model, Virasoro minimal models, where this is true are the one that we found. Also, it's generally believed that only the vertex, the affine cuts with the algebra that appear in physics, they all happen to be at very special fractional value of the level, which are known as boundary admissible, and those are precisely the one that we found. And we've also checked, this is a somewhat painful experimental mathematica work that it appears to be true in more elaborate examples. And this is something that I have some slides, but I surely will not have the time to present. There are some funny cases where it's on the verge of being false, but then there's a very non-trivial mechanism that makes it true, which encourages us to think that this is not just some random bullshit. Okay, so we are speculating that this is a generic property, which means that there's a lot of work cut out for the mathematicians that they could go ahead. They're better than us at computing these kind of characters. There's a plethora of 4D theories that come from that we know about, and we are conjecturing that they all have this power. Okay, so I want to switch gears slightly. And this is a summary slide that will not do justice to the topic. I want to say this again a bit conceptually. So what is the lesson so far? These VOAs appear to be intrinsically related to the physics of the Higgs branch. And it's not just the geometry of the Higgs branch, but there's a little bit of extra data that is involved in it. And one approach is the one that I described so far, which is this Higgs scheme that knows about nilpotents. But there's another, perhaps more physical approach, which is to think in terms of the effective field theory as we move on the Higgs branch. And again, experimentally, we have found that there is a way to reconstruct the VOA if you tell me not just about the geometry of the Higgs branch, but about the kind of theories you find as you move at the point of the Higgs branch and flow to the infrared. So if you tell me about the effective field theory that you find on the Higgs branch, this is enough data to reconstruct the VOA. And essentially, we're able to realize the VOA, the original VOA, in terms of free fields, which are what? The free fields that describe the Higgs branch, free hypermultiplets, and a bunch of additional stuff that describe the intrinsic interactive degrees of freedom on the Higgs branch as you flow to the infrared. So the simplest example is the one, again, the one where we have this A1 d-odd cases, where we have this SL2 at this fractional level. In this case, again, the Higgs branch is always C2 mod Z2. But if you move on the Higgs branch, you find that you do not just find a free hypermultiplet, but also an interacting superconformal field theory, which is our friend from before, the 2.2n+1 minimal model. And so what is actually true, you can reconstruct this gadget in terms of a bunch of free bosons that correspond to the free hypermultiplets dressed with this Virasoro minimal model. And you get a free field construction where null relations are automatically obeyed. And the story is extremely general, and we have some work in progress where we do this for all rank one superconformal field theories. Okay, so I think I should start concluding. So what is the summary so far? So there is this funny map from 4D to 2D. It obeys some rigorous axioms and then some properties that at the moment are completely experimental. One is this quasi-Lisp property, which is a statement that the associative variety is symplectic. That seems to be always true because we believe strongly in this six-branch construction. We have this other story about free field realization, which I just briefly mentioned. And then, admittedly, more tentatively, we have this other story about classical freeness. And the challenge is to deduce this conjecture probably from the axioms. And here, four-dimensional unitarity must be crucial. And I have to be brief, sadly. But I want to at least the following two slides I need to present briefly. So far, I mentioned the beginning is Hart filtration, but I didn't harp on it. And the Hart filtration is absolutely crucial. So from 4D, we know that we should be able to keep track of the second quantum number, R. And for example, affine currents have R equal to 1. I remark on that because those are the ones that give me global symmetries. But it turns out, for example, that the stress sensor also has R equal to 1. Now, if you know about the Sugawara construction, that's a little unusual because the stress sensor is J squared. So you see that this R filtration is a bit tricky. It's not just you give R to some generators and you take the products and R adds. It's some more involved way in which things are working. In particular, J squared in this case of Sugawara stress sensor, is not 2, but it's 1. And the Higgs operators are the one where R is maximal, where R is equal to H, as I've emphasized before. And one structural feature of this filtration is that because R is the Cartan of an SU2 non-abelian group, a triangular inequality must be obeyed, which means that when you take products, you don't get arbitrary things, but things get truncated by the triangular inequality. So the product here is short. And we have found that this R filtration actually is very naturally encoded in the free field filtration I had earlier. And that's actually very natural because the free field construction know about the stuff that comes from geometry, the free hyperts, and the stuff that is extra. And so by keeping track of the charge assignments of the free hyper, we can actually reconstruct the R filtration. And finally, my final important slide has to do with unitarity. So the challenge is to deduce this striking experimental property from the axioms. One axiom I just mentioned is the fact that you have to endow the OVA with additional R quantum number assignments. And the second fact that clearly must play a central role is the fact that the 4D theory is unitary. So you can use the CPT symmetry to define very universally for any chiral algebra that comes from 4D, an antilinear automorphism of the VOA, such that sigma squared is minus 1 to the 2R, and such that given a generic operator A of the chiral algebra and its friend conjugated by sigma, this particular combination where I see there is a very non-trivial sine factor that depends on R is positive. Okay, so this is not something you could ever guess if you purely live in two dimensions, but the fact that you must descend from a four-dimensional unitary theory means that the theory must be equipped with this sigma operation that implies a certain positivity property of two-point functions. And under certain assumption about how the R filtration work, we could prove that the only theories where the Virasoro Fubi-Virasoro algebra are precisely the one that we encounter. So that, I think, gives us a blueprint. So this is essentially my last slide. The emerging picture is that these VOAs are very special. They can be built in terms of a bunch of irreducible blocks, which are the ones that you encounter if you move at the generic point of the Higgs branch and you flow to the infrared. Those are, by definition, theories that have no Higgs branch. So in my terminology before, they're Lisse VOAs and free fields. But even these Lisse blocks are very constrained because, for example, in the case of Virasoro, they couldn't be anything. They have to be this particular 2,2n plus 1 sequence. And so, okay, it's clear this is the very beginning. There are many mysteries, but hopefully there is a classification program. This I'm going to skip. And I'm going to reiterate my message. The challenge in this business is to precisely find what's special about this map. There are many striking experimental facts. And our strong hunch that the correct additional axioms that you must add is this additional quantum number and for the unitarity. And hopefully that will be enough. Thank you.
Questions? Well, maybe one silly one. When you were trying to revert the arrow, would find the VOA associated to one of these given the French break the scheme, I think it was.
Yep.
What I was thinking about. So that map turns out to not be work invertible, but at the same time, it was true that these algebraic structures were in one-to-one correspondence with the.
Sorry, the map actually turns out to be invertible in the cases of interest for us. For reasons that we're studying the same examples over and over. And the same example appear to have very special properties. So for example, these 2,2n plus 1 are simultaneously are the only ones are compatible with Ford unitarity. And the only ones have this property where the error is actually invertible. So for example, I could land on a theory where I only have tq equal to 0, either from 2,7 or from Ising, 3,4. But of course, what appears in our story is 2,7. And it's precise for 2,7 that the error is invertible. For Ising, there's a non-trivial kernel. So presumably, for the unitarity is what controls this funny property. But at the moment, it's experimental mathematics. Yes.
So if you have a perfect algebra, it is not quasi-Lisse. Does it have a semi-ring?
Which is not quasi-Lisse.
As you said, it looks like the Poisson algebra has a center.
The Poisson algebra has a center.
Also has a center.
I don't think it immediately follows, but I don't think it immediately follows.
The jet construction would.
Yeah, the jet construction is unrelated to that, but so I don't know. It's.
I was wondering, would this be a line of attack? Because what if the vertex algebra for the n equals 2 theory cannot have a center, I don't think. Because that one seems unlikely.
Right, so. That's an idea. So. So one of the things that, again, experimentally is true in all of our examples is that the stress tensor is always nilpotent in RV. And that had to be if you believe in our Higgs-Brent story, because we believe that this, well, the stress tensor is not a Higgs-Brent generator. So I need to get it out of my way. And so the only way I can get out of my way is if it's nilpotent. But OK, that's what we want to be true. But in any given example, this is always a miracle, a little miracle. A little miracle occurs, and it's true. So it would be great to have a way to prove it axiomatically.
So I guess you can think about Carroll algebras that are associated for the defects inside the 60 tier, like
yes,
the critical level gas smoothing.
Yes.
Have you checked which of these properties exist for those?
Critical level gas smoothing, of course, is a little funny because of this center. Right. So
this classical. Is positivity.
I suspect that they would fail, but I haven't thought about it. Yeah.
Well, one of tasks is really causing useless to fail in this example.
Yeah.
Any more questions? Let's thank the speaker again.